Hey, Ryan, what kind of coffee do you like?
Heineken?
Heineken? Fuck that shit! Spark plug coffee! That's what you'll drink tonight! I mean, after all, coffee lovers know that the difference between a good cup of coffee and the best cup of coffee is freshly roasted beans. But with most coffee you get at a cafe or your grocery store, you have no idea when it was roasted. But Sparkplug Coffee custom roasts their own beans and guarantees that their fresh premium coffee is delivered to your home or office within a week. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste. And they offer autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time to make the switch and make the best cup of coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
That sounds pretty good. I don't even like Pabst Blue Ribbon to begin with. Fuck that shit, too.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Welcome to our strange world, movie devotees, and thanks a heap for earing up our podcast. We were an AFI movies adventure for a while there. Now we just review flicks that we feel like reviewing. I am the youthful sleuth who's in way over his head, Ryan Ellis, while my co-host and wife remains the girl next door blonde with ugly cry face, Laura Dern. I mean Bev.
That's me.
Bev, not Laura Dern. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Blue Velvet. Dennis Hopper uses an infamous word that no one else in the movie ever does, except for a single instance by Dean Stockwell. What is that word?
Is it fuck?
It is fuck.
And Dean Stockwell, when he's mimicking him, says, here's to your fuck,
Thank
right?
you, IMDb trivia, yeah, because Frank makes him say it.
Yeah.
That's the great thing about this film, one of the obvious themes about this film, the Leave It to Beaver daytime, where none of the other characters are ever controversial, not in this way at least, and certainly not violent and profane, and then the sinister horror movie nighttime. So not a very deep trivia this week, but the word is fuck.
No, but it's interesting. I think it reflects a choice they made to make sure that Frank, in a very weird and dangerous world, always remained the most vulgar and shocking character.
By far.
Oh, yeah. Not that you needed to aid Dennis Hopper's performance, but... Mm.
I think that Dennis Hopper just wandered in this movie and was Dennis Hopper. Chop his hair from Easy Rider days, maybe, cut the hair off, and just sick him loose in this movie. Then he just has to read lines on cue cards and just be himself.
Yeah.
He probably wasn't a rapist back in those days. That's a bad accusation. Anyway.
Back in those days, like he has been other days.
Well, rapist, that's a little strong. The Next 100 Project's 34th movie, Blue Velvet, was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. But of course, it didn't make it. Dino De Laurentiis' Entertainment Group, yeah, that's a film company that was set up just for this movie, set the film loose in September 1986, back when movies did have a slow rollout. It wasn't a hit on any level, but it did break even. Bev, explain the movie to people who aren't familiar with Blue Velvet anymore with this skinny.
Kyle MacLachlan is Jeffrey Beaumont, a college kid who returns to his small North Carolina town when his father suffers a stroke. He finds a human ear in a field, then stumbles across a violent and sexual mystery involving Isabella Rossellini and Dennis Hopper.
Dennis Hopper. Or, in a nutshell, they would have gotten away with it, too, if it weren't for that meddling kid.
I love that you said that, because I totally have Scooby-Doo in my notes. And the first act of the film is building up like a Scooby-Doo mystery.
And that ear is all it comes down to. The Beaumont family is the reason this movie even happens. Because if his father doesn't have the heart attack, then Jeffrey doesn't come back. There's a stroke. Whatever it is. If he doesn't have that happen to him, then Jeffrey doesn't come back to see his father and then discover the ear, and the mystery progresses. The Beaumont's out of the picture. I guess Frank gets away with it.
Yeah, you're right. And you know what else is the Scooby-Doo connection I just thought of now? Scooby-Doo, always the villain, is in disguise. Frank wears a disguise in this film. He's the handsome, or the well-dressed man.
That's right. You're correct. Another comparison would be Wizard of Oz. I've heard that Lynch has often gone on the Wizard of Oz path in a lot of his films. And Dorothy is a big one. The femme fatale named Dorothy, of course. We know that from Wizard of Oz. All right, a few numbers before we get going into the proper conversation. Rotten Tomatoes critics, 94% of them liked the movie, 60% fresh, 4% rotten, and 88% of audiences. Those are higher numbers than you might expect because this movie did split people a lot back 30 years ago, including Siskel and Ebert. They were very split. If I can find the link where Siskel likes the movie, it was one of his favorites of 86, and Ebert hated it.
Yeah.
Didn't get it at all. Woody Allen, though, who was a fellow Best Director nominee along with David Lynch that year, and did win a writing award in 86, actually, for Hannah and Her Sisters. Loved the movie. It's one of his favorites of that year, maybe one of his favorites ever. And the movie was 77th at the 1986 U.S. box office. It made about $8.5 million, so like I say, basically breaking even. MGM, by the way, has the rights to the movie now, so Louis B. Mayer must be rolling over in his grave that they have the rights to a movie like this, especially when they have Wizard of Oz in their canon also. Well, I guess Warner Brothers has that one now, but you know what I'm saying. Blue Velvet, he would not have made that movie back in his day.
Even by today's standards, it's a shocking movie. Mm-hmm. It's really vulgar.
Well, one of the things that Siskel said about it was, he compared it to Psycho, and he said, we're going down this path, oh my god, and then they cut to Ebert doing the whole thing where he's pissed off that Isabella Rossellini is abused. What I don't agree with in Ebert's complaint, showing somebody being raped, abused, humiliated, is the device that they're going for. I guess what he was saying was that when you have the daytime stuff, which is played for comedy, it's not funny, laugh-out-loud kind of stuff, you don't really truly laugh out loud in the whole movie, but it is more light. Of course, we already made that point. The nighttime stuff isn't. And I guess his whole point was he didn't like that this woman was being treated this way when it's also this, na 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 na, we're having fun, we're having fun. But I don't think the movie is really having fun. They're mocking the Leave It to Beaver bullshit with, hey, what's really underneath the surface of your small town or even your big town? I don't know if you and I, even in this big city of Toronto, really want to know what's going on behind the closed doors of our neighbors.
Well, even by the most depraved thing you can think of that happens in real life standards, this movie really takes it to the next level. I don't think this is the type of thing that's going on behind closed doors in most neighborhoods.
Maybe it is.
I'm sure something like this has happened and is happening, but it is pretty extreme. Now, to answer the accusation that it's a misogynist movie because it displays this violence, the portrayal of misogyny is not the same as misogyny. Right. Showing somebody, or racism, or, yeah, or anything like that.
Any of those isms.
It isn't by its own nature. But I can totally understand how this movie can draw criticism for making her abuse titillating.
I don't think that is. The scene where he's talking about, when she shows up naked and abused.
No, that's not titillating.
That is not titillating in
any
way.
No, it feels like real trauma. And actually, David Lynch said that he based the scene mm-hmm. on an incident in his own childhood when he was way too young to witness something like that. A grown woman at night was walking around his neighborhood totally naked, out of it. Mm-hmm. Just that alone, just the out of placeness, it haunted him. It really bothered him. It traumatized him. He says he remembers crying and running home and they called the police. And so that's why he included that scene, because there is something so upsetting about that. As much as the most upsetting scene in the movie, which is, of course, the rape scene, yeah. which is in no way titillating. There's yeah. other stuff in that movie. Her expression of PTSD, which I have pretty mixed feelings about.
Hit
that,
me! Hit me!
Right. Is it accurate? Does it need to be accurate? It doesn't offend me because the whole movie's just so out there. I don't know. For whatever reason, it just doesn't bother me on that level. But the rape scene with Frank, that better bother anybody. If that doesn't get under your skin and creep you out and make you not just feel sorry for Dorothy, but make you deeply uncomfortable about the voyeurism aspect, because mm-hmm. Frank and his whole calling her mommy, calling himself baby, he's baby and then he's daddy, right. what he actually physically does to her, which I can't bring myself to describe, it's really upsetting and not your regular TV rape.
Because Jeffrey's in the closet watching, and then the question becomes, if you were in a closet watching this going on, and you don't even know this woman, you just met her a few minutes ago, she means nothing to you so far, would you stop it? You've got no weapon, and this guy clearly is a violent, psychopathic kind of person. You've witnessed this for only a few minutes, what he's done already. You don't want to get involved in this.
And she knows he's in the closet. She tells him, if you come out, if you interrupt this, I'll kill you. So there's this complacency on her part. Of course, we understand this because her husband and son have been taken hostage. I think Jeffrey should have put it together by then. She's only going along with all this because she doesn't, and he doesn't want her husband or son to get killed either. And he knows that could be the consequence of him revealing that he's in the closet. And Frank is terrifying. Mm-hmm. From the moment he walks in the door, first you have just his presence, and then you have Dorothy's reaction to him, which is amped up fear, immediately complying with every weird order that he gives her. Then there's just his behavior. By the time he starts doing the mask, breathing the mask, if I was standing in that closet, I would piss myself right there. I would sooner kill myself than let him find me and find out what he would do to me.
When the scene ended, if he was just gone and we never saw him again, that right there is a classic performance, and that right there belongs on the villains list. One scene alone.
Yeah, agreed. And I know he's over the top. I don't think anybody ever criticizes him for that, because there's certainly nothing natural about his performance. He is peak Coke years Dennis Hopper. There's so much energy, and it's almost campy, but it's not. It's actually terrifying. And this is part of David Lynch's genius, is he can make anything terrifying. So when he makes something that's already scary, and he decides to make that a terrifying moment in the film, it's incredibly effective. I don't even know where to begin. Like, the fact that it's shot from the perspective of the closet, that you feel like you're in the room with this, witnessing this, at any moment Jeffrey could be revealed, you know the consequences would be terrible. Although the consequences are not actually terrible when Jeffrey's caught with Dorothy later in the film.
It might have been different if he'd been caught then.
Yes, but because he's caught in the hallway, all he's doing is talking to his neighbor, and the punishment for that is getting driven out to the middle of nowhere, have the shit scared of him, and beaten up to the point of unconsciousness.
The injuries he suffers a few different times, the knife wound that she gives him in that first meeting, and then when Frank beats him up, those injuries heal pretty fast. Now, you could say that's just continuity. You could say that's just a movie trick. You also could imply that Lynch is saying it probably happened, but this is Hollywood, or this is movies, or this is fantasy, so it's just forgotten.
And like every movie and TV show does, too. You could complain about that about virtually every movie where a character suffers an injury. It would be unusual for a director to choose to accurately show what the healing process is like for a
character. In Chinatown, Nicholson, we talked about the nose that's like that, slowly healing the rest of the film, and it's a great device they use in that film.
But it is an unusual choice for a director to make.
Standalone that actually played off the injury and said, the guy's going to look like this for most of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
That scene also has shades of Rear Window, where Jimmy Stewart's character, now it's Kyle MacLachlan, is in the room. Now, Jimmy Stewart's got a broken leg. He's an older guy. He's across the way. He's not really doing anything wrong quite the way that Jeffrey is, where he's in this place, and he's snooping. He's not even honest about why he's in there. He's pretending he's a bug guy. By the way, there's one of the examples of the great contrast. So many great contrasts in this film. And one of them is the bright, normal-looking kitchen with this unusually dark, strange-looking apartment. She has a kid living there, and, okay, Don Valens may be a weird guy. He's supposed to be involved in drugs, too, and that's why Frank has kidnapped him. By the way, that's one of the elements of this film. I'll, by the way, a lot in this podcast, probably. The story we don't see is just as interesting as the story we do see, including whatever Don was doing, that he ever got involved with Frank in the first place.
I know. The whole story with him, we never meet him.
Getting cut off?
Yeah.
Was the ear cut off in that field, or was it in the guy's pocket and it dropped out? That's implied in some of the stuff you read online, that one of the guys is punished by Frank for having the ear get found in the first place.
And what about the whole story with the yellow man?
Yeah.
You know, you walk in...
He's a cop.
In,
let's not forget. He's
yeah,
a cop.
Yeah. And we walk into Dorothy's apartment at the end of the movie, and he's standing there lobotomized by a gunshot to the head. We have no idea how that happened, how Don is dead in the chair. Yeah. The yellow man is lobotomized. They never bother explaining it. And what a creepy scene. Everything that happens in that apartment is so unsettling.
Yeah.
Lynch has this supernatural ability to creep you out. Because I've seen this movie several times before, I was trying to watch for little details here and there of how exactly he does that. I mean, he does so much with audio. That's no
one
secret.
Of the great sound designers in the history of movies as a director. Alan Splett was the sound guy, but Lynch as a director, unbelievable sound design over and over again.
And he started it with Eraserhead. Eraserhead's soundtrack is probably the best thing about it. It's incredible. It really gets in your head. He has this way of picking sounds that you would never even put in that place, and you don't even notice it. There's like a subliminal effect it has on you of just making you uncomfortable and making you feel very tense. There's also weird little details when it's still the Leave It to Beaver section. The first 30 minutes are pretty tame. It feels not even like a movie. It feels almost like a TV show, and it's so sanitized.
Yeah.
So one of the scenes I love is when he finds the ear and he immediately brings it to the detective, who's his neighbor, who he knows. The detective opens up the bag, takes a look, goes, "That's a human ear, all right." And it's really...
As if it's a Twinkie.
As if it's a Twinkie. He doesn't even change the expression on his face. It's creepy that he doesn't react. But that is kind of how TV is. And I think part of what Lynch is saying is, you know what's creepy is how people pretend this stuff doesn't exist,
even
or that they're okay
North Carolina.
With it. Nothing to see here. Nothing bothers me here. It starts right at the beginning. And you know something's off right at the beginning. I appreciate that Lynch made the choice to do the famous opening, which I can't
remember. White and blue. The red flowers, roses, the white
picket fence,
literal
blue
sky.
Fence. And you see the firefighters, they're waving, they have these big ridiculous grins on their face, and it's all over the top, and there's the strapping dad watering his lawn, and there's this setup for the joke that hose is kinked and it's going to spray him in the face, but what's really kinked is one of his blood vessels, and then he suffers a stroke right there. But the style never changes. It still is a slow motion. The music is still playing. The colors are still bright and American.
Yeah.
And he's lying on the ground, clutching his neck in pain and freaking out. And it's an incredible moment.
And the dog wants the water. And the dog would eat him if it had the chance to, because it is an animal. And then we cut underneath the grass and we see the bugs going crazy.
Which is a great motif in the film, too. The bugs
go underneath and see what's really under the rot and everything. And then the last shot of the film, or one of the last shots, at least in the whole film, is the robin. The robins have come back and everything's okay again.
One of the most artificial things in the film, too.
The fake looking robin. Yeah. But more importantly than it's being fake is what's it got in its mouth? A worm. Because even these saviors, as Sandy, Laura Dern's character, says, are killers. Like, everything's a killer because we have to eat. We all have to eat something.
The robin is the hero because it kills the bugs. It's a bug in its mouth, not a worm. It's actually one of the beetles that you see in the beginning.
Right.
And there's a moment where his Aunt Barbara, that's a funny character in the film's Aunt Barbara, especially this scene where he threatens to punch her in the face. Oh, Aunt Barbara, I'm going to give it to you. If you don't shut up, I'm going to give it to you. She's asking why he looks beat up. Anyway, Aunt Barbara says, oh, that's terrible. I could never eat a bug. Of course, most people can never eat a bug. So the question is, you have somebody like Jeffrey, who doesn't belong in the daytime world because he has this curiosity, he has this perversion. You know, she asks, are you a detective or are you a pervert?
He's both.
He's both.
And he's a weirdo, too.
I think every detective has to be a pervert. A robin has to be able to eat a bug so that they can bring love and sunshine back to this world for everybody who couldn't possibly
and
eat
and survive.
Bugs.
Frank would argue that he does what he does because he has to survive, because anybody in a movie who's a villain is going to say that what they're doing is necessary for this reason or that reason or another reason. And one of the more important scenes in the whole film is when we see Frank crying while watching Dorothy perform Blue Velvet the second time.
He needs her.
He is holding a piece of Blue Velvet. By the way, something I just looked up last night. I wanted to see if Lynch was at the Oscars. The only nomination this movie got was for Best Director. We'll get to that in a few minutes. There's some interesting trivia about that. We'll talk about that later on. But when they show him in the crowd, he's holding a piece of Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
Isabella Rossellini is his date, by the way. They were dating after this movie, maybe even during the movie.
Dennis Hopper?
No, David Lynch is holding a piece of Blue Velvet. Oh. Probably not anything sinister, but more a matter of, it's a good luck charm.
Yeah, but he's associating himself with one of the worst characters ever put on celluloid.
But in the most important moment that Frank Booth has, where he's crying, drinking his Pabst Blue Ribbon, and clutching a piece of Blue Velvet, he actually is in love with this woman. And they talk about this in the Mysteries of Love featurette that is online. It's about an hour long, actually. It's a long documentary piece about the movie. So look for it. I'll try to include a link on the website on YouTube. It's also on the DVD and the Blu-ray. But Hopper talks about that. He's somebody who's in love and just can't express it very well. I don't think he's excusing the guy for being a psychopathic
racist.
But that's typical for an actor. He's got to find the link for when he's playing a villain. And Hopper, by the way, we talked about how this is just him being him. He was coming out of drug rehab, so he wasn't a druggie anymore. And I don't think he got back into it either. I think he actually managed to kick it for the rest of his life. He lived for another 20 or so years after 86.
Yeah, he didn't live to be an old man, but he didn't die young either. Mm. He begged for the part. He really, really wanted
because
it.
Because he is campaigned. Frank.
That's what he said.
I am Frank.
I need to do this. And thank God he did. This is one of those performances where it is impossible to picture anybody else doing this. Except maybe Nicolas Cage. I think like that because he was too young, but because he was in Wild at Heart a couple years later with David Lynch and Laura Dern. Mm. I know you hate that movie.
Not a fan.
I'm more fond of it than you are, but I haven't seen it in a long time.
Harry Dean Stanton was in line for it. I don't think he would have been right for it. He's been in other Lynch movies, including The Straight Story, which I just watched a few days ago. I love that movie so much. That is such a beautiful film. Richard Farnsworth is just wonderful in that. That's his last movie, because he got cancer and shot his own head off rather than die of cancer. But Robert Loggia was also in line for it, I was reading, and then he ended up being one of the bad guys, I guess the main bad guy, in Lost Highway. I can see Loggia playing it. Hopper's better, but Loggia's not that many steps behind. I don't think Harry Dean Stanton would be right for it. And Nicolas Cage, like we just said, was way too young. Cage now probably would have taken it too far. Now, during the rape scene, let's talk about that again, because one of the things that I didn't really understand the first time I saw the movie, I wasn't a huge fan of this film. I wouldn't say I disliked it, but I was kind of, I don't know, let's move on. Because it's one of those movies I watched so many films on videotape back in the late 90s when I was a movie fan and wanted to catch up on all the things I hadn't seen before. Probably saw Pan and Scan Print as well, by the way. But anyway, didn't understand the film. But one thing that I noticed, and maybe because they didn't want to show Hopper's junk, he doesn't seem to have his pants off when he's supposed to be fucking her. So I often wondered back then, I saw the movie a few times, and even after the second time, I thought, is it supposed to be that he's just pantomiming that he's fucking her?
He has an orgasm.
I don't feel that now. Like each, no, no, I don't.
Equal parts rage as orgasm. He reaches down there, so I guess it suggested it could, although it feels almost irrelevant because.
No, I think the movie's saying he is raping her in the usual way. He's actually having intercourse with
her. It happens really fast at that point, though.
But because he's doing the amyl nitrate, I guess he's turned on by that. There's something that's on that Mysteries of Love thing, too. Hopper reveals that the original thing with that gas was supposed to be that it was just helium. And helium doesn't mess you up. All it does is make you sound like Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, it doesn't get you high.
Right. So then it's just this high-pitched psychotic weirdo doing these things, which, as Hopper pointed out later, he's the one that suggested, let's do amyl nitrate. I've had some experience with this, David. Let's do that, because that actually messes you up. And they show the scene where he's going, with his hand, because as he points out again in that documentary, you can see rings come out of your hand or the lines of color when you're doing LSD or amyl nitrate. So he's playing this guy who's messed up on this drug, but had it been helium, he's not messed up on anything. He's just that nuts. And one of the great shots in any movie, especially from a horror movie standpoint, we're talking about horror movie month now, we're into October. This isn't a bona fide horror movie, but the moments with him are scary. And one of the best ones is when he's in the car, does the amyl nitrate, turns to look at Kyle MacLachlan, and his eyes are 9 feet wide. They're bigger than yours and Fox's combined. That's a pretty scary moment.
His face with that mask on. And the mask also plays into that bug motif that we talked about. And Kyle MacLachlan pretends to be an exterminator. She calls him the bug man. Oh, the ants all over the ear as well.
Yeah, and also the camera dives into the ear. And at the end, it comes back out of his ear when he's just laying in his backyard. As if to say that this is all over with. I don't think this movie in any way is saying this is just a fantasy or a dream. Other movies have played that notion of what's real, what's not real. Total Recall, The Matrix, and on and on.
Mulholland Drive.
Right. We'll talk about that later in this podcast. But anyway, the notion that when the camera goes into the ear, now we're getting into the shit. And when the camera comes back out of Jeffrey's ear, everything's fine again, except with the Robin, maybe not so fine.
Yeah, because the Robin's there to save them. And the last thing we
but
do
it's still
see
a killer.
Is Dorothy reunited with her son.
And that's why it's really hard to hate this movie. Ebert has his problems with it, but how can you really truly hate a movie that does have this wonderful happy ending? It's sappy, but everybody wins. I mean, she loses her husband, so that's not completely a happy ending for the Valens family, but she's got her son back. She's gone through this horrible experience. That's not good either. And then everyone who's been involved with Jeffrey's witnessed, including Sandy with her ugly cry face, has seen some things. She knows that her boyfriend has been fucking this woman, but then she's with him. So both the femme fatale and the girl next door win, and our hero wins.
They win, of course, when Jeffrey kills Frank, when he takes down the bad guy.
Right.
But when he kills Frank from the closet, in a great, terrifying ending scene, you were so scared for him. But when Frank finds him in the closet and he shoots him in the head, a lot of movies have shown some gun violence in some pretty graphic ways and shown blood and expressions on characters' face that have made it feel really surreal, but they show his head explode and they let all the characters come in and see his body. Laura Dern comes in and sees his body, which is a silly TV-ish trope.
Why is she
there? The girl, like, why would the love interest be there to see this scene? What she sees is his corpse with his brain bits littered all over the room. It's an intentional choice that he made to be like, death is gruesome even when the bad guy dies. It's not pretty. Jeffrey shot this man's head open, and he's okay with that. What kind of person does that make Jeffrey? Well, the kind of person that you need. But he has a sickness inside him, too.
Because Frank had just killed the yellow man seconds before in that same scene, and he's killed Don Valens. Well, maybe his goons did, but somebody killed Don Valens not long before in that same apartment. That surreal thing. Well, yeah, again, you picture a kid plays in this apartment, or at least he did, and now you've got this sickening, awful scene of two people that are, well, one of them who already is dead, and the other one's about to be dead, and then the third one, being Frank, is about to be dead in that exact same place. I guess the Valenses, what's left of them, are going to move.
Well, maybe that's why they chose to show her and her son in the park. Because they can't show them in that apartment.
They're between houses. You said Sandy a minute ago, so she is the girl next door character, Laura Dern. She is Bruce Dern's daughter and Diane Ladd's daughter also. Diane Ladd is in Wild at Heart and got an Oscar nomination for playing a remarkably over-the-top bad guy. Way worse over-the-top-wise than Hopper is in this film, believe it or not. You've seen it, so you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Dern also was in Inland Empire, which is the last movie that Lynch has made to date, 10 years ago. We talked about creepy moments. She's not a bad guy in that movie. I don't remember the plotline of that one. I saw that one probably the year after it came out because I would have rented it and saw it at home. But there are some moments with her that are creepy and weird and freaky as well, as I recall.
I haven't seen that one.
Check it out one of these days.
Yeah. Well, I should just because it's a Lynch film. I mean, Shame on me.
But how about her introduction when she walks down the street? It's not weird or creepy, except she comes out of the black. So it could have just been some sinister bad guy, too. They don't play that up that she is. She, of course, is the complete opposite. Or you see a scene like that in Lost Highway. Bo Pullman walks into the dark, and you wonder what's really going to go on there. And when he comes out of the dark, all these kinds of strange things happen. And that character in that film is effectively a bad guy. He's certainly not a hero, but Sandy is completely innocent. Great casting. You get this perfectly blonde young woman to play the complete opposite of Isabella Rossellini, who's not a bad character, not a bad person at all. I mean, she's been victimized, but as we said a few minutes ago, she's getting off on it, as does Jeffrey. There's this sadomasochistic thrill that they both seem to have. When he doesn't want to hit her, when she demands that he does try to avoid hitting her. He tries the best he can, but then again, is he really trying hard enough? Because he does end up smacking her, because there's a part of him that probably wants to do what he saw Frank doing. I think Lynch is suggesting that we all have titillating moments. Lots of people out there would never even think or want in any way to hit another person when they're trying to give them pleasure. Even if they were commanded to, they would say, I'm leaving the room. I'll give you that. But I think Lynch is saying that a lot of people out there, the perfect boy next door, well, he's not perfect, as we said a minute ago, but if he's given the opportunity, will do some seriously awful things to somebody, especially when she wants him to. And why does she want him to? Because she's getting off on it in a strange way, too. She's not enjoying the rape when Frank does it, but there's a part of her that also gets off on being in charge. And both Dorothy and Frank say during their sex scenes, when he's raping her and when she's, not raping Jeffrey, but when she's commanding him, they both say, don't look at me.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So there's a term I've heard that gets used in the BDSM community, which is getting dominated from the bottom or getting dommed. The sub in a BDSM relationship is the one that's really in charge, because they're the ones that get to call the shots and say no, and she's saying, hit me, hit me. She's ordering him around. There's definitely a power to it, and she probably hates herself for everything that she's complied to do, and there's the self-loathing, there's PTSD. If it was just that he met this woman and he had this relationship with her and there was no other context, then you could probably put it in the framework of, oh, she's just a sub. She just likes to be hurt during sex. But no, it's in the context of this event following immediately after a very violent, terrifying rape that also involves her husband and her son. The worst thing you can imagine happening to a person, and then immediately she wants to have this sex with Jeffrey that is violent. I can't say that I know remotely enough about either PTSD or BDSM to speak on what's normal and what's not normal. I think it's probably from 1986, a pretty progressive view of how rape victims react, because they don't react the way they're supposed to. They certainly don't react the way that they do in TV and in most TV and movies, where they're the perfect forlorn victims that just want to be saved and rescued and held and have blankets wrapped around them.
And let me posit that movies can do this. I'm not going to accuse any real person of this. I'll just do movie characters. I can say whatever I want about a movie character because I can interpret it whatever I want. I'm saying they're portraying that this woman gets off on it.
She does. In that moment, that is exactly what she wants. And she does get off on it. She
if wants Don somehow just walked into the room in the first scene we see with Frank when he's raping her, if he just got free and walked in there, if he could just stop the whole thing, would she want Frank to just vaporize, leave, be gone from her life nonviolently, and then just go back to her normal life with Don? Let's assume she's not having violent sex with him. It's typical kind of husband-to-wife sex. I think the movie's saying that she wants something like that. Probably not from Frank, but Jeffrey's the next best thing because he's a nobody to her. It's not her husband, and it's not the guy who is holding her husband. It's somebody else altogether, and she can get what she really wants from a third party, a fourth party, whatever Jeffrey actually is to her.
So she's in this intolerable position where a man that she's terrified of is repeatedly raping her and has her family hostage. I don't get the impression for one frame of that film she's anything but terrified of Frank. She kind of knows how to manage him in scenes, but I get no impression that there's any connection coming from her towards Frank.
I think a film hangers there is.
I disagree. If she could vaporize Frank, she would without a second thought. What she wants is her family back. I'm sure that would be like an ideal situation for her. And I think what she wants from Jeffrey in that moment is just something to help her cope. Because she's not going to get her family back. There is no current hope for her that this situation is going to resolve itself and Frank is going to vaporize and she's going to get her husband and son. And that moment, she just needs something to help her deal with this intolerable pain and terror that she's living with every day. And that's just what she wants in that moment. It's a hard character to analyze because she's crazy. She's lost her mind. This situation has driven her mad.
We don't know how long it's been going on. It may be months.
Right.
probably not years, but it's probably more than weeks, though, too.
She knows what to do. She knows what Frank wants. They have a routine.
Right,
yeah. So it's obviously been going on for some time. This is not, like, a new situation to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's frazzled. She's just at her wit's end.
And she likes to sing Blue Velvet.
I like to sing Blue Velvet. I've had that song in my head ever since we saw the movie. And every time I sing it, I have to sing with her accent. And she's not even a great singer. She's a good enough singer.
I think if she's a good singer, it would ruin it. I think it would be a bad idea to have her be a good singer. And even more so when you do see that key shot of Frank crying.
Maybe even Frank's infatuation with her is part of what helped her get that gig in the first place. Maybe she never would have been hired to sing at this nightclub, except that this big criminal has a crush on her and wants to see her.
Because again, you wonder what's really behind the surface of the story. Was she performing in there for years, whenever she got a chance to, when she wasn't just being a mother and a wife, and then he saw her? Did he see her first? Did he get into Don's business first with the drug deal stuff? Which the movie I don't think ever makes clear. I read that online. I don't think I'd even know that. There's apparently a 4-hour cut of this that never came out that Lynch did. He did so much extra footage, which I guess he always does. He's one of those directors, unlike we did Hitchcock a few weeks ago with Notorious, where it's cut off the heads and the tails and the scene's done. Lynch is one of those guys that shoots a lot of footage and then cuts it all down. So maybe that's where you found out, maybe that's why people know that Don Valance is a drug dealer. Because otherwise, why is he kidnapped? What in the world's going on? It makes Frank actually more of a bad guy if you don't know that backstory. But then it also gives you that strange sort of thing where he may have seen Dorothy and Don's got nothing to do with anything. He's just, I don't know, selling insurance. Whatever it is, he's not a bad guy in any way. And then Frank sees her, obsesses about her, kidnaps the guy, kidnaps his son, just so he can do all these things to her, which makes him be more of a strange bad guy. Not just a bad guy, but a strange one.
Another important scene that they cut out that changes the tone of the movie significantly, Jeffrey has a girlfriend back in college. There's a scene where he calls her and says, my dad's okay, he's in the hospital, he's recovering. And she's like, I love you, do you love me? I can't remember exactly how the scene goes, but it is strongly implied that they are having a serious relationship, so that immediately when he meets Sandy and he starts carrying on with her, you automatically think, oh, he's a bad dude. I'm really glad that they take that detail out, because there is that great dichotomy between his relationship with Sandy, his relationship with Dorothy. They satisfy two completely different needs in him, and he seems equally committed to both of them, or at least equally infatuated and interested in both of them, but it's like he's two different people in those worlds. And I'm glad it's not complicated by this notion right off the bat that we would have felt like he was a dog, that he was always playing Sandy. No, he really does care about Sandy. He really is falling in love with her.
But he also has to help Dorothy and is getting off on helping Dorothy.
Yeah, and he is allured by the dark side of her life and the world that she lives
in. We talked about that famous image of him in the closet. Before I ever saw this movie, I saw that image, and I always thought he was a bad guy. Because he looks so sinister, the light coming in through the slats. We've seen other scenes in movies where people are in closets, where they're either the hero or the villain, or they're being chased, or they're the ones who are chasing, where they're about to pop out and hurt somebody. Usually it's the good guy, though. You think of Halloween. Jamie Lee Curtis hides in the closet to get away from Michael Myers at the end of the film. And then when he comes through, the way the light lights his mask, he's already sinister in that whole film, but he's even more weird because he's so bright all of a sudden. He's just so plain as day, and he's only about 5 feet away from her, too. That's one of the more horrifying things in Halloween, really, is that shot when he's trying to get to her in the closet. And Jeffrey in the closet, too. He looks like he is not just a pervert, but a sinister killer, even though we, of course, know he's not. Now, I mentioned Dean Stockwell at the top of the podcast because he's the only other person in this movie that ever says the word fuck other than Frank. At least the vicious drug dealers aren't homophobes, because clearly Ben is gay.
He's wearing makeup.
Right.
He's and also
Frank
clearly
and his boys seem to be just fine with the fact that this guy is different and weirder than they are. They're pretty weird. But he's gay, and they're okay with that.
And the women in the scene as well. You think of gangsters' malls, they may not be the most beautiful women, but these are far from beautiful women.
They're and fat.
They're fat. They're old. They're dressed sloppily, but also like tramps. I've never seen other movies do this, really. Maybe John Waters movies, and those are played strictly for comedy.
Right.
It's one of those details in that scene that are so confusing. Because of the introduction to this world with Frank and the rape scene, which is really your first glimpse into what is going on when he meets Dorothy in that apartment and all the events that take place in that scene. Before that, you're in this kind of 50s Nancy Drew story.
Apart from the ear, nothing is really all that
weird. And suddenly it becomes this virtual snuff film level of depravity. So you already feel like anything could happen in this movie. And then you get to Ben's apartment, and it is just the weirdest. He does that amazing lip sync to the Roy Orbison song. And he seems like he's half asleep all the time. He's probably implied that he's a heroin user because, I mean, I've seen people high on heroin before, and that is exactly what they seem like. They just seem like they're about to nod off any second.
Well, let's not forget, he is holding the son and the father.
Yes, they...
Frank's behest, but still, he is part of this, and so are these women.
There's a beautiful shot, which is the reaction shot of Jeffrey watching Ben singing, and the look on his face of, what the fuck, is amazing. But as he's standing there watching, and one of the thugs has his hand on his neck and is holding him there, and Dorothy comes out from the back room where she's just visited with her husband and son, and she looks forlorn. Mm. As sad as we ever see her look in this film, and her wig is askew. And, you know, a robe.
Key moment that she's wearing a wig, yeah.
She's wearing a wig even in the last scene, by the way, when she's reunited with her son, which is kind of a weird choice. I don't know if it's intentional or if it's just because...
It's what we know her as the whole film.
Yeah.
But she takes that wig off at some point. We mentioned Psycho a minute ago. There's a wig in that film. Somebody's got a whole disguise going on. Lynch is known for disguises and all that kind of stuff. And also, another bit of a Psycho thing, the key moment in both films, the shower scene, one of the most famous scenes in the history of movies in Psycho, and the closet scene in this one, the man you don't know is there, which is the horror, I guess, although we're in with Jeffrey and we're in the shower with... So in both cases, actually, that's the good person. But one has to witness something bad happen. The other one is the one who has something bad happen to that person. So Norman's wig makes him some other person. Dorothy's wig makes her some other person as well. We only see her take it off one time, and it's when Jeffrey's watching her from the closet. It does transform a character when you see them doing something that doesn't seem necessary. She's not actually a performer. It's not like she's Dolly Parton. I've heard Dolly Parton say it takes a lot of money to look this cheap. We know she's got a lot of makeup on, but she's also probably got a wig. So that kind of person, when she's performing in front of people, just appearing in front of people, has to look like Dolly Parton. But Dorothy Valens is a nobody who's performing in some nightclub. It doesn't matter what she looks like. No one would really care, apart from even Frank. But she's wearing a wig, like you say, even at the very end.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with her hair. You do see her hair. It's not like it's all gray or there's any obvious reason why she's wearing a wig at all.
It's just part of the phoniness that Lynch is lampooning or mocking or cutting into.
Artifice is a big part of it.
That's and maybe
a big
he's
part
saying,
of, like, a lot of what he does. It is a theme he revisits over and over.
And maybe he's saying that the small towns are even worse for that than the bigger towns, although Mulholland Drive, L.A., huge artifice. But we'll talk about that soon.
Speaking of artifice and things he repeats over and over, lip syncing, isn't that? That's in Mulholland Drive as well as
Candy Colored Clown.
Mm-hmm. And in Wild at Heart.
Another thing I want to say about the Sandy slash Dorothy thing for Jeffrey, it gets back to Lost in Translation. Bill Murray's character bangs the lounge singer, and he doesn't sleep with Scarlett Johansson. And I suggested in that podcast that Scarlett's the one you don't want to corrupt, and the lounge singer, because you don't care about her, is the one you do want to corrupt. Now, Jeffrey cares about both in this movie, but he's got the woman he's willing to corrupt, who wants to be corrupted, at least with Jeffrey she does. And then Sandy, he only ever kisses her at the dance. Mysteries of Love, that's where the documentary's name comes from on the DVD and the Blu-ray and the special that's on YouTube. Apart from kissing her, he never crosses that line. It's still a 50s kind of romance. No clothes even come off versus woman's naked. They're fucking, we don't really see that happen, but we know that they're doing that. I will corrupt this person, but I won't corrupt the other one.
I get the impression that he cares about them both on those levels. He loves Sandy in part because she's so uncorrupted, because she truly is innocent. This stuff, when she learns about it, is such a shock to her. When she sees Dorothy naked, she's traumatized. Mm-hmm. Even though he's kind of taking charge and taking care of the situation and she's putting it all together, she makes the ugly cry face. She makes it for, like, the whole last act of the movie, and there's scenes
she's
where...
always done that. You watch Laura Dern crying movies, and that's the way she always looks. It's Claire Danes has the wiggly chin. We've talked about that before. That's just the way she cries.
I love Laura Dern. She's not the prettiest girl. Actually, it's a little bit distracting that she's supposed to be this high school goddess dating the football player and... The glow of light, the blonde hair, the dresses, the whole
thing.
By
Hollywood standards, she's not the most gorgeous woman who's ever lived. But if she lived on our block, she would stand out. Let's put it that
way. Okay, that's fair. And it's not like Kyle MacLachlan is some fox that could have any girl he wants.
Good-looking kid.
He's good-looking, but he's not a 10 either. He's not Hollywood hot either.
In one of his first movies, he was in Dune that Lynch did, the infamous bomb a few years before this. And Dino De Laurentiis produced that. And the reason why Lynch got this movie made is because De Laurentiis saw the script and said, yeah, let's make a production company, get that movie made, but it had to be with a very low budget. McLaughlin's in Dune, then he's in this film, and I don't think he ever worked with Lynch again, even though they had this good relationship.
Are you kidding me? Twin Peaks?
Oh, sorry.
Come on, Dale Cooper!
I'm thinking about the movies. That's the funny thing. I'm thinking about Lynch's movies because most directors we've ever covered and all the movies we've now done in the Top 100 Project, the Next 100 Project, the Now Playing Project, the Now 100, all the movies we've ever covered, very few directors have ever done TV shows. They may have done one episode of a TV show. But of course, Lynch is maybe best known ever for Twin Peaks. That's true. Even more than Blue Velvet
and Mulholland Drive. Like most people, well, especially most people my age, that was my introduction to David Lynch. And I was probably too young for that show, but it opened my mind. I loved it, and it made me dive deep into this world of weird things. If I could gush about it for a minute, you know, at the time, no other TV show did anything like what Twin Peaks was doing. It fell apart in season two. Yep, a lot of criticisms are fair, but what it did accomplish was unprecedented. And TV today, the current golden age of TV, certainly has a debt to pay to Lynch. And at the time, it was really unusual for any A-list director. He wasn't A-list director for any film director,
though. No, he was A-list.
He was? Okay, so there you go.
Elephant Man, Eraserhead, the people had revered before that, Blue Velvet. That's A-list.
Okay, so for him to make a television show in the 90s, that did not happen. Mm. Actors rarely went back and forth between TV and movies.
It was slumming.
It really,
really was.
Your career
was over. Your movie career, at least, was done.
I'm so glad that changed. That has been such a refreshing reboot of the industry that TV has become.
Because TV
so
now
much more prestige.
Is generally better than movies.
And directors are not shy about working on TV shows. Even if it's just a one-off in someone else's TV show, feature film directors all the time will go and work on TV shows.
Scorsese and Tarantino have done it.
Yeah.
Tarantino was doing CSI, and Scorsese directed episodes of some of the shows he's produced.
So they weren't even like prestige dramas. We're not even talking about HBO dramas.
Yeah.
Soderbergh did The Nick.
Yeah, he's a producer, and I think he must have directed some
of
those.
I'm sure if I had thought about this before, and I could rattle off a ton of examples.
But Lynch was unusual.
Lynch did that, yeah, it was super unusual. It still stands up now. I rewatched it, I think, with you not long after Lost finished. Still weirder than Lost was, and at least for when it was good, right up until the moment Laura Palmer's killer is revealed.
When it probably should have ended.
When it totally should have ended. Right up until that moment, it is one of the greatest shows I've ever been on television.
And I'd never seen it until we watched it about 4 years ago, I think it was. I liked it okay, but I didn't love it as much as you did. But I certainly respected what he was doing and what he had been going for on television back in the early 90s, which is shocking to think they ever got away with. Not on HBO or Showtime, on these networks where you could do blood, violence, boobs, swearing. And he didn't have those things anyway because he couldn't on mainstream TV, but just the shocking nature of what was going on in the show.
And Twin Peaks has the scariest villain.
Killer Bob.
Of any TV or movie, nobody has ever scared me as much as Bob.
And for those who know about Bob the Killer in that movie, the alter ego of Ray Wise's character, Laura Palmer's father. Spoiler alert, but that show is 20
years
old.
Yeah, yeah. We all
coming
know who
back,
killed Laura
by
Palmer
way,
now.
And coming back, the show has not been released as far as I understand. But they're bringing back another version of it. I don't know much about it, but Lynch is directing it.
That's right. I heard about that for a while, and then maybe they've been off making it, but it seems to have fallen off the radar a little bit. I'm really apprehensive. I liked the movie, but I'll admit, it's pretty disappointing. It doesn't really share the same
I saw the movie before I saw the show,
so
I didn't know what the hell was going on at all.
That's a mistake. And then when you saw the show, you would have known who the killer was all along.
Yeah. He was just a stagehand that I guess was just doing his job, and Lynch saw him and thought, he looks pretty freaky, let's make him the killer.
Oh my god, even when I think about him and talk about him, I'm telling you my blood pressure's going up right
now. Lynch
just
had some of the great bad guys in the history of movies, in this case a TV show, with Frank in this movie, Robert Blake in Lost Highway, Bob, those three alone. I'm forgetting other examples, probably in other films. Well, I guess Lorne's mother, Diane Ladd, in Wild at Heart is a great villain, too.
And even though there's no villains, there are some moments in Mulholland Drive that scare me like nothing else in film. That movie terrifies me.
Yeah. We're about to terrify you pretty soon when we watch it again.
It's true. It's kind of losing its effect on me now that I've seen it a few times. The dumpster scene, oh my god, the first time I saw that, I was like, stop this movie. I'm never sleeping again.
Yes, so Dennis Hopper did Hoosiers this same year, and that was the movie that got him the Oscar nomination, which puzzles him too. I love Hoosiers, and he's very good in the film, actually, but this is definitely the better performance, although maybe people thought, well, that's just Dennis being Dennis. He'd experienced all those things before. Maybe not the raping, but most of it.
I think probably a lot of people watch Blue Velvet, especially the first time you watch it. It's so surprising. It's kind of hard to process. I mean, you said the first time you saw it, you couldn't really make heads or tails of it.
Yeah.
And I struggled with it the first time I saw it, too. It wasn't until repeat viewings that it cohered and I understood what he was going for, and then you appreciate the brilliance of it. this is weird now. It was extra weird in 86. So I can see how people would have just not known what to make of it, but still appreciate the energy of his performance, the uniqueness of his performance, and then reward him for the more conventional film. Although not a conventional film to get an Oscar nomination for, because it's just a feel-good sports movie, mm-hmm. right?
And he's very good in Hoosiers.
I love
Hoosiers,
it's unusual to get a Best Actor nomination.
Supporting actor. Like supporting okay. actor. But there's a few elements in his performance we haven't talked about yet that I think are compelling to bring up now. One is that you don't see him until 42 minutes into the movie, which I guess is Norman Bates-esque. We see him sooner than that, but he doesn't become Norman Bates the bad guy until about 50 minutes into Psycho.
Yeah, that's but we don't Janet see Frank Booth at all until...
Right, 42 yeah. minutes in. That's, even though I actually looked at the timer. That's the first time you see him.
Yeah, and we could have seen him when they go to the bar to watch her perform, because presumably he would have been there watching her.
But they don't show
but
him.
But they yet. Don't know to look for him, so they don't show him at the bar.
And I didn't think to look for him when we watched the movie, maybe in the background. That would have been smart, actually, if he was out of focus or something in the background, but I didn't actually notice him. Another thing is he's wearing a ring on his ring finger. Maybe it's supposed to be that he's married, which makes this even more sinister. And the last thing I want to bring up about his character is that music really fucks him up. Because he loves Candy Colored Clown in Dream Song...
Yeah.
Way too much. He has to hear that song before he starts messing with Jeffrey. And of course, when he hears Blue Velvet, he's weeping in the crowd.
He's singing along with Candy Colored Clown, and he's looking at Ben with love in his eyes.
As he does with Isabella Rossellini singing it.
Yeah.
He can't well, not that, but when
contain
she sings Blue Velvet.
His emotions when somebody's singing.
And Rossellini is Ingrid Bergman's daughter. We talked about that when we did Notorious. Helen Mirren was supposed to have played the character originally, I guess. And Rossellini talks about that quite a few times in Mysteries of Love. Because the movie wasn't well received by certain critics, probably Ebert was one of the more major ones that ragged on it. And she thought, well, maybe you should just cast Helen Mirren. I fucked it up for you. But she didn't fuck it up for him because she's pretty damn good in the movie. She's not the one you think about first in this film. Obviously, it's Hopper. And probably second would be McLaughlin. But it's a great femme fatale performance with the screen time she has, which isn't that much. And yes, she has to be naked through a lot of the movie. And sorry, Roger, I think that's the point. That's the movie. That's what you're looking at. And I love Roger Ebert. We've quoted him so many times in our podcast, but I think he's just dead wrong on this one.
We rarely disagree with him.
But he's the one that said, a movie is not what it's about, it's how it's about it. This movie is not about raping a woman, it's about how she reacts to it. This is what happens when he took it too far one night. It's bad enough he rapes her in her apartment. If Jeffrey hadn't been there, she probably just cleans up and goes about her night because she's got to do it. What else is she going to do? Her husband and son are still out there and she needs to get them back. But this is the one time, and again, we didn't see it, the story behind the story. How bad did it get that night that she's wandering around with nothing on? And as bad as Frank is, why is he letting her do that?
I know. I think that some people just have a sensibility that they can only tolerate so much depravity and violence. Maybe it was just the state of mind he was in when he saw the film, or maybe it doesn't matter the artistry of it, it crossed a line and he can't watch that much suffering and still enjoy a film. Especially because it doesn't necessarily treat it that seriously. Although I think it does, but not as seriously, say, a movie like Hotel Rwanda, where the whole movie is about suffering good and about how this is injustice.
There's no humor, there's no satire going on there. And that's what this guy's playing. And it was years later. We can't judge Ebert for what he said in 86 when the guy was years away. But Quentin Tarantino, one of the devotees of Lynch, whether he wants to admit it or not, I think he would probably admit it, Mr. Film himself, Quentin Tarantino.
Also cut off an ear in one of his films.
Right, in Reservoir Dogs. There's a lot of similarities. There's an article I read about that, how those movies are so similar. Tarantino also mixed tones all over the place, especially in Pulp Fiction, his masterpiece that Siskel and Ebert both loved.
So do the Coen brothers. I mean, Fargo is another great example of a movie that can be both hilarious and horrifying, not on Blue Velvet level, but certainly more than would sit well in any comedy.
Yeah.
And those moments are played to be serious and to shock the audience.
And the woman who's kidnapped, I mean, Dorothy's not kidnapped in this movie, but she might as well be, ends up dead in Fargo. So there's
yes.
also that. As bad as Dorothy's
innocent.
Treated, she at least lives. So a few more of the cast members we got to talk about. Dean Stockwell, who does play Ben, has been in the business for 70 years and he's still acting.
Wow.
Apart from this, I guess he's best known for Quantum Leap and Married to the Mob, where he got a supporting actor nomination. Priscilla Pointer, we're going to cover a few weeks from now, and Carrie's in the film. Brad Dourif from Cuckoo's Nest is one of the thugs, as is Jack Nance, who was the star of Eraserhead. They don't really have much screen time, and if you didn't recognize them, you'd probably never pick out that, oh, that's the guy from Cuckoo's Nest and Lord of the Rings.
I always see Jack Nance in Lynch films, because he's in every Lynch film.
Since I think he's died, though, so maybe he's not in any
okay,
anymore.
Okay, he was.
And Lynch isn't making movies, I said that a minute ago.
Yeah.
Well, David Lynch, the writer and director, known for Twin Peaks, Lost Highway, all these great classics. Eraserhead, people love that so much. I'm a big fan of The Straight Story, having seen that again recently. Mulholland Drive, of course. But no more movies. I don't know if he's ever going to make another one now. He's getting up there, and it is 10 years since he made one, which was Inland Empire, which didn't make any money at all. Nobody went to see it, and maybe he thought, I'll just do internet stuff, and I'll be an artist. He was an artist. They talked about that on the Mysteries of Love documentary as well, where he's somebody who's actually a painter.
If there's something about the industry that's rubbing you the wrong way, and you've made enough money that you can walk away, for God's sakes, walk away. This man never cared about money. He took off his salary to make Blue Velvet. He isn't in this to get rich. He's in this to just be able to do what he wants. So if he reached a point where he could do whatever he wants, why not?
And I think that's what this is, because he's making movies online, at least, or little shorts that no one's really seeing. Certainly not in the volume they would if it was in the theater. I've actually rarely seen a movie he's made on the big screen. I saw Mulholland Drive. Is that it? I guess that's it. I didn't see Inland Empire on the big screen, and I wasn't really watching movies when he was making them. And he was sporadic about making movies even back when he was in the early 90s and into the late 90s. So, yeah, I've seen one of his movies on the big screen, but let's put it this way. He would be a must-see director like PTA is now, or like Quentin Tarantino is now, if he was still making movies every couple of years or so. And he just isn't, so it's a shame. His producers, and there were quite a few of them, but Fred Caruso, who did Network, which we covered way back when, and also that guy worked with Brian De Palma quite a bit, and then Dino De Laurentiis was, of course, the executive producer on the film, which is a 2.35:1 silky-looking Blu-ray. It's pretty good. The cinematographer, Frederick Elms, who shot Eraserhead, and then later on Hulk, as in the 2003 version. The editor was Duane Dunham, who cut Return of the Jedi, which Lynch could have done. He could have directed that, but he didn't want to. In the end, and he also was the editor on both the Twin Peaks series. What did you think of the cutting, and what did you think of the look of the movie? The look, you have to agree, was great.
Oh, yeah. And it's really carefully crafted by Lynch. The look and the sound, that screams him all the way. Especially knowing the initial cut was 4 hours long. The extra challenge of going between the daytime world and the nighttime world, I think the editor did a perfect job. It's really hard to set and keep a tone like this when it's as challenging as this movie is. But also, because I've seen it many times, I catch all these crazy continuity errors that imply to me that they really had to cut and paste scenes. Like, the first time they go see Dorothy perform, she's actually wearing a different outfit at the beginning of the song than she is when the song closes. Yeah. Oh, okay. But it's probably because they took the closing scene from her performance the second time they visit the club.
Okay.
Because she's wearing that outfit. A good director, a good editor knows Scorsese famously does not give a damn about continuity because the audience is invested. Even if they notice, they're not going to care.
They want performance. And his editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, want performance.
Yeah, kudos to that. I mean, it's rare that you really get to hear the story about what goes on behind the scenes in the edit room. And hearing this and what they had to work with, good job. They obviously picked the right scenes and the right shots and got the story together the way it needed to be.
And how about the composing? A theme that you've not liked in our podcast for so many times.
Well, it's intentionally cheesy. It's really over the top. Well, Angelo, melodrama.
Angelo Badalamenti, this is his first ever movie. He's worked with Lynch on, I think, everything that Lynch has done since this project as his composer. He's never been nominated despite some great scores. And he even did one for Secretary, a non-Lynch movie that you love so much in 2002. What do you think about Badalamenti?
Speaking of BDSM.
Right. What do you think about Badalamenti, and not just this, but other movies he's done, Lost Highway and, of course, Mulholland Drive?
One of my all-time favorite scores is the score for Twin Peaks.
Oh, no, of course that, yes.
Yeah, and I really like him. And it sounds like him, but it also sounds perfectly appropriate for the film where it's playing on the themes of the two songs in it. Roy Orbison's song, what's it called again? In Dreams?
In Dreams.
In Dreams.
Or Candy Colored Clown, if you go by Hopper's version of it.
Yeah, and, of course, Blue Velvet, and it's mimicking intentionally those melodramas from the 50s. It's intentionally over-the-top corny when it needs to be, but also blends into the background and builds the tension beautifully when it needs to do that too. So he's a really versatile composer. I like the score for this film.
And playing off the past, we see Jeffrey's mother watching an old movie, I think it's supposed to be, at least twice. It looks like it is maybe a 40s crime thriller, which is what he's actually involved in. He's in a film noir of his own choosing.
He's a gumshoe detective.
So it's like she's watching his story in black and white, because it is a black and white movie she's watching, despite this being a color film.
And that's probably how Jeffrey is meant to have believed his story would play out in the sanitized,
because everybody usually won in the 40s and 50s, especially in the 40s. Well, then again, I guess they didn't always win, but generally, right triumphed over bad, or it evened out at the very least. It wasn't necessarily that bad guys would get away with it. But I guess it kind of evens out in this one too, doesn't it? And as we said, in the end, you've got people who are pretty happy despite some of the losses they've suffered.
He even gets the girl.
He does get the girl. See if that lasts for a long time. We would know because Robin suggests you're both bad and good at the same time. So The Influence. This set the tone for Lynch's career even more than I think Eraserhead had. And people, of course, have raved about that movie. I saw it once. I didn't dislike it. I don't know if I really got it. I respected it. But I think this set it more because it is a little more mainstream. This is about as mainstream, along with maybe Elephant Man and The Straight Story, as Lynch has ever gotten, because he's had some very twisted, weird movies that you just cannot decipher. But the fun of Blue Velvet may just be that it is right there for you. There's not really anything out there that is not figure-outable.
There's nothing otherworldly. He'll kind of have either the supernatural or get inside the head of somebody who's crazy,
yeah,
like an Eraserhead or a Mulholland Drive. So in that way, it does always keep one foot firmly planted in reality.
And you could suggest that this movie's even saying that when it goes into the ear, the camera does, that signals that Jeffrey's imagining everything. And when it plays out at the end, that it's all worked out. I don't think that's this tone at all or what it's saying. But in movie language, you could make that argument.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I'm just saying that that's movie language. Just like I say that she gets off on the rape more than a real person probably would, because that's movie language for you. Okay, more influence. Twin Peaks, obviously the set tone for that. The Lynchian theme of duality, wigs, and disguises, he's had that in so many films. And doppelgangers. One of the things I love in Lost Highway so much is you've got one person, Patty Arquette, playing two women, but you've also got two men, Bill Pullman and Balthazar Getty, playing one person, effectively, in that story, if that's the way you want to read it. Duality and disguises.
That's something that happens in Twin Peaks as well. You have the same actress playing Laura Palmer and her cousin Maddie. And then you have the real-world versions of certain characters, and then they have their other versions in the Red Room, which also is another Lynch thing. Red curtains.
And blue curtains as well.
Yeah.
For Shaw, this picture are the blue curtains. Then you get into the red, white, and blue.
What's it called? The Black Lodge. The Black Lodge.
Right, yeah. Tarantino had to be influenced by Blue Velvet, as many directors were, but he would also go on to pervert innocent songs in a racier, violent context, just like Blue Velvet, and especially In Dreams are in this movie. Because In Dreams is not a song you think about in a sense of, holy shit, this is freaky and weird, but it became that after this movie. And if you ever heard the song, I've never heard the song out of the Blue Velvet context, but if I did, I would automatically think of this, and I'd automatically think of Ben singing it with that light in his hand instead of a microphone.
Oh, what amazing image. Think about
Frank saying right after it's over, "I'll fuck anything that moves!" And then the great edit where it just cuts and he's gone and you hear the car screech off. Great editing.
Little comedy duet moment. Let's go for a ride. You want to do that?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think so. You don't think what? Go for a ride. That's a great idea. Let's go for a ride.
All right. The credentials for the film, awards and list section. The one nomination for Best Director. He's one of the few directors that have been nominated for an Oscar where no other nomination came from the movie. It happened to Scorsese with Last Temptation of Christ. It happened with Fellini's Satyricon. And then guys long before that. But Lynch is the only person where it's been twice. Blue Velvet, Mulholland Drive, no other nominations except for him. Also Altman on Shortcuts. But Lynch has had that happen to him twice. Very unusual. The editing from this movie, the sound design, and a lot of other things should have been nominated, but they were not.
He was nominated for one other movie too, wasn't he?
Mulholland Drive. And also he was nominated for Best Director and for, I think, writing Elephant Man.
That's right. Okay. That's
so the one he's had three directing nominations.
I knew he had been nominated prior to making Blue Velvet. It was for Elephant Man.
Yeah. The film was 96 on the top 100 thrills of the AFI list. Maybe it could have even been higher than that. Frank Booth was 36 on the bad side of the heroes and villains list. Probably should have been higher than that. And it's 8th in the mystery category of the top 100 genres. At least it made that one because that was dominated by Hitchcock. A little too much Hitchcock in that list, I thought. And it was nominated for the top 100 songs with In Dreams, but no Blue Velvet?
Yeah, that is so weird. The songs list, we talk about this all the time. How absurd their standards were. First of all, it was a song that existed prior to the movie.
Second, In Dreams. They recognize that.
The song that was performed by an actress in the movie rather than lip-synced by a character. And I will agree, if you were going to compare the scene of Dean Stockwell lip-syncing In Dreams to the scene of Isabella Rossellini singing Blue Velvet on stage, of course In Dreams is a better scene, but Blue Velvet is through the whole movie. It's what the soundtrack is based on, and it's such a big part of the film. It's such a strange choice.
Okay, long podcast. Let's wrap it up with our final thoughts on Blue Velvet.
It's rare that a film is this effective as both entertainment, because we didn't mention it is a pretty fun movie to watch, and fine art. I think it's brave enough and interesting enough that it's not just a good movie. It is truly art. And 30 years later, it still feels original and shocking and essential.
It's one of those films that I will always remember and probably always come back to when you think about movies that get into the duality themes, the light and the dark, not subtly, but a very effective way of doing it. And making a movie with actors who you don't really talk about anymore. Kyle MacLachlan was in Showgirls. That may be the last big movie he was in, and people rake that one over the coals all the time. Val Kilmer, by the way, could have played the character, but didn't want to. He thought it was pornographic, and then it's been said he would have done the movie that they actually released in theaters. But he's not really a player anymore. Laura Dern is. Okay, granted, she is. Hopper's dead now. Lynch isn't making movies anymore, so this really is more of a time capsule than you might have thought. We're not going to see any more Blue Velvet influences from the people that made the movie, I don't think, because the director's not making movies, and some of the other major players are just not involved the same way they were before. Now, I agree with what you said about being art. It is art, and it's not easy to watch, but it's very effective.
It may not be easy to watch, but it is kind of fun.
And freaky, and that's why we covered it in this month, because it's scary in the usual way, but it is crazy weird.
And even though, like you say, it is a time capsule for the careers of these people, 30 years from now, I think it will still be as fresh. It is a timeless movie.
It was ahead of its time in 86, just like Pulp Fiction was by Tarantino.
And because it kind of lives in this 50s, it isn't really of its time.
Yeah.
It will always stand apart like that and never be pigeonholed as an 80s film, because it doesn't feel like an 80s film.
And by the way, the guy who won Best Director that year was Oliver Stone for Platoon, which was a good choice. It's a well-directed film.
There's no way Lynch was going to win if the film wasn't nominated for anything else.
That's the thing about all those people that ever were nominated for just one award. Maybe somebody from long ago did, but when I looked at it, I thought, none of these people ever won. And why would they, really? How are you going to have an award just for Robert Altman winning for Shortcuts, directing that, and yet nothing else from it?
I'm a little surprised that Hollywood would have embraced this film because it was so weird scandalous.
But they wanted to honor him that one way, which is unusual because we talked about it on Lost in Translation, where Sofia Coppola won the writing Oscar. For her being nominated may have just been the recognition. Of course, it also got nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor. But her win, or even just the nomination, a lot of times that's what it is. If a movie's weird, or if it's out there, or if it's indie, whatever it is, and they think, okay, it's not quite in our mindset as the Academy for Best Picture, but let's give it a writing nomination, which is a strange thing, because the writing is always the most important thing in any movie, if you really get down to it.
There's also 10 writing nominations.
Between, supporting
and adapted. There's only 5 directing nominations, so that's a big part of it, too.
All right, well, that's Blue Velvet, then. We'll be off next week for the Canadian Thanksgiving. Yes, ours is more than a month ahead of the Americans. On October 17th, we'll delve into our second straight Freaky Lynch product as we cover the number one film on the recent BBC Culture poll, the creepy conundrum that is Mulholland Drive. The coming attraction trivia for Mulholland Drive. David Lynch is known for casting singers in acting roles. Name at least 2 musicians who acted in, but did not musician in, Mulholland Drive.
Okay, so for the answer to that, please tune in to our Mulholland Drive podcast 2 weeks from now. In the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. And don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Shut up. Where's my bourbon? Wait, I should try that again. Shut up! Where's my bourbon?
And cut.